This is the One True Faith Podcast, an audio-only version of the Catholic television show produced by St. Michael's Media and hosted by Michael Boris. For more information, visit catholictelevision.org. Season 2, Episode 12, The Crusades and the Inquisition.
Hello, everyone, and welcome once again to The One True Faith. It's the show that we say is the most disturbing hour on television because we talk about the truth and we talk about where you're going to spend eternity. And eternity is, of course, the most important question in our lives, where we wind up eternally, heaven or hell, and it will be one or the other for everyone here and everyone sitting at home. That's the most important question of your life. The Catholic Church was established by Jesus Christ, the Son of God, in order to help give every aid possible to get us to heaven through the sacraments, through living close to Jesus and to God the Father, to the Trinity, becoming as holy as possible. Because of that singular mission of the Church, Jesus knew the Church was going to be attacked constantly. Now, sometimes the things that are said about the Church and the faith are merited because there have been bad people in the Church, just as there have been bad people outside the Church. But the Catholic Church itself is the bride of Christ, and it, being the bride of Christ, imbued with that divine character, cannot sin and cannot err. Its members can sin. Certainly, I can sin. You can sin. We all have sinned. But the Church itself, as the bride of Christ, remains sinless. And in the end, when the world comes to an end, Jesus will come back for his spotless bride and take her back up to heaven. And hopefully that will be everyone sitting here and everyone who's hearing this at home. Because of that unique character, the Church gets attacked constantly. It gets attacked from martyrdom for the first two or three centuries of the Church, to heresies in people who disregard its teachings, to reformations, to every other thing, constantly under one form of attack or another. And when you're in the world, as we're spread all over the world now, well, one part of the Church can be experiencing one type of attack, while the other part of the Church, like the Church in China, for example, is experiencing a physical attack or physical martyrdoms in many cases. The Church can also be attacked through ridicule and through a putting down and a misrepresentation of the teachings and a misrepresentation of history. And because of that, something we want to talk about today are two items in history that the Church gets slammed for constantly. They even make funny comedy movies and do skits about these. Mel Brooks, for example. The first item is the Crusades, and the second one is the Inquisition. Now, the Crusades and the Inquisition are seen by many historians to be these horrible black marks on the Church. Just atrocious. And this proves that the divine character of the Church, that the Catholic Church and the popes and the bishops claim they have, this really disproves that because no church established by God would ever do these horrible things. That's the line of reasoning. Well, let's take a look at what some of these really horrible things are. Are they really as bad as history has painted them? Are they purely good? Well, let's talk about that for a little bit. John Paul, in the year 2000, made a public apology for all the sins of the members of the Church. Sins of omission, things they didn't do that they should have done, and things that they did do that they shouldn't have done. Among those lists, he also included some of the sins committed in the Crusades and the Inquisition. Let's talk about this and get sort of a firmer handle on exactly what we're talking about with the Crusades. So some of this is going to be history because, by necessity, we're talking about the past. When we speak of the Crusades, we're actually talking about six different military campaigns. They lasted from about 1100 to about 1300, give or take a couple of years. So for this 200-year time period, there were essentially six major military campaigns that were going on. They're popularly understood as these power-hungry popes reaching out to grab as much land as they could possibly get. Let's take a look at some of the historical truths about that and see if that's the case. There are three major players in the Crusades. Lots of people don't stop and think about this. They think, oh, it's the Catholics against the Muslims. No, there's a third party that sort of began and ended the Crusades. And that third party was the Byzantine Empire. The Byzantine Empire, where the Orthodox churches were, let's go back and do a little history. In the 600s, the middle of the 7th century, Islam arose in the Middle East. It swept through the Holy Land, all across North Africa, jumped Gibraltar, went all through Spain, and moved up into the heartland of modern-day France. One big, huge, almost crescent, you might say. In the course of doing that, what a lot of people don't know is that there was a very peaceful period between the time of Constantine, which was in the 4th century, and the rise of Islam in the 7th century, this 300-year period, where the church had a very vibrant presence in Europe, in the Middle East, and in North Africa, like three legs of a stool surrounding the Mediterranean. It was, in a sense, the old Roman Empire, the borders of the old Roman Empire. When Islam came through and swept through the Middle East and Northern Africa and into Europe, it essentially took two-thirds of the land, and it took it by force. It was not until the year 732 when a French warrior by the name of Charles Martel turned back the invasion in Europe at a battle, very famous battle called the Battle of Tours in 732. He forced Islam back south of the Pyrenees Mountains into Spain, and that was it. And that was how things held in Europe for the next few hundred years. Europe itself was Catholic, but the Middle East, the Holy Land, and North Africa was now Muslim, and becoming more and more Muslim as time went by. People don't know. You don't realize what the original history of the church was. St. Augustine was from North Africa. He was Bishop of Hippo. One of the greatest scholarly collections in all of Christendom was in Alexandria. All of this was destroyed when Islam came sweeping through. So, as you might imagine, there is this great animosity centuries before the Crusades ever begin, as Catholic Europe sees itself under always this kind of imminent threat that Islam may come crashing through again. Fast forward a few hundred years. It's the year 1071. Muslim forces are gathering again in Turkey, and they crush, absolutely crush, the Byzantine Empire's army. Byzantium has no more defense. 20 years before that, the church in the East and the West had split. The Orthodox had split off from Rome. So the Byzantine Empire now sort of contained the Orthodox Church in the East, sort of modern-day Greece in that area, and then the rest of Europe, Western Europe, was Catholic. Well, the Byzantine Emperor picks up the phone and says, "Hello, Pope, we need some help. Can you get over here?" So Pope Urban II, in the year 1195, 20 years later, calls for a crusade to do two things: recapture the Holy Land and save the Byzantine Empire. Pope Urban II did not say, "I'm going to go wipe out Islam." He responded to a call from the Emperor of Byzantium. That's how the First Crusade began, as an answer to a call for help to help save us so we don't get overrun. First Great Crusade happens. It's made up mostly of noble French. They have their own little private armies. Remember now, you're talking about just 500 years earlier, which in European time is not that long of a period. These are all the sons and daughters of the barbarians. The French, the German, the English, the Irish, the Celts, the Gauls, all the Visigoths, all of these people are all barbarians. And the church over these centuries has baptized them and sort of calmed them down a little bit, although it's still kind of a lusty crowd. But they're baptized, and they're becoming a little bit more controlled than they used to be. The nobility of mostly France and some Germans get together, put this huge army together, and start marching towards what is Constantinople, the capital of Byzantium. When that happens, they get there, and the emperor looks out his tower and goes, "Whoa, that's a pretty big army. I'm not at all comfortable with the fact that they're sitting right under my gates. Quick, throw them on the ships and get them over there so they can kill the infidels. Ship them off, get them out of here." So they do. They throw them on. And in just 4 years, 1099, that first crusade had first arrived at Nicaea. You remember Nicaea? How important is Nicaea to the Catholic faith? Ever heard of the Nicene Creed? They recapture Nicaea. They essentially actually bargain. They talk the Muslim forces out of even fighting. There's not really much of a battle at Nicaea. They just leave. So they give them Nicaea, essentially. Then the crusading army marches down to Antioch, essentially wipes out the force there, slides down the whole rest of what is the modern-day Middle East, Lebanon, Syria, and recaptures Jerusalem for the faith, and puts a buffer between the Islamic forces and the Byzantine Empire. They've got their breathing space, and they've recaptured the Holy Land. When the Muslims came in and swept into the Holy Land, they desecrated the Holy Sepulchre, Jesus' tomb. They destroyed Christian church after Christian church. They ripped Christian shrines to shreds. This is what happened, and this is why when all of this information sort of filtered back to Europe, the Catholics in Europe were furious about this, and that's why when the Pope said, let's have a crusade, they said, sign me up. I want to go back and do that. I want to go back and protect the Holy Land.
This is The One True Faith with Michael Voris. For more information, visit CatholicTelevision.org.
It took 4 years to recapture the Holy Land, and this sort of era of peace settled on the Holy Land in a rather large area along the coast, essentially from the southern side of Turkey down through what's modern-day Holy Land and down around to essentially the Gulf of Sinai, that region. That area, which is sort of moon-shaped, seems to sort of getting a little theme here, right? Things seem to be crescent-shaped everywhere you look. That area became known as the Levant, L-E-V-A-N-T. And actually, it was noted by contemporaries at the time that it was a very tolerant place. Jews, Christians, and Muslims all conducted business once the peace had settled in. They all conducted business together. Even friendships developed. Intermarriages happened. The idea that this was some forceful occupation, like, you know, the Nazis moving into Poland and there was this constant, is not the case. There was a sort of an era of peace there. Matter of fact, that era of peace so alarmed some people that they saw the sort of the will and the resolve of the original crusaders starting to kind of backslide and become a little lazy. So a gentleman over in France said, you know what? You might have your little peaceful island there in the sea of all of that hatred, but eventually that hatred's going to come washing up on your shore. And we have to have people there to protect that. What we need is we need warriors who will never, ever give up the fight and who will always be watching, always be on the watchtower, making sure that your enemies aren't ready to break the walls. When the barbarians were converted 500 years before this throughout Europe, those conversions happened largely because of the efforts of monks in monasteries. They went out and they preached the faith, they baptized the barbarians, and they slowly, slowly cultivated Europe and sort of calmed things down. So here we are, 6 centuries later in the history of the church, and a man by the name of Bernard gets the same idea. I'm going to go get monks, and we're going to make them military units, and we'll ship them over to the Holy Land, and they will protect all of the Christian interests in the Holy Land. Bernard was Bernard of Clairvaux, who eventually became Saint Bernard of Clairvaux, whom the doggy's named after, at least. He formed a group of knights in history. This is where knights came from for the first time, in any sort of recognizable form. They were monks who were warriors, who were trained military units, and they were disciplined to a T. Think of a group of priests who are Navy SEALs. That's what these warrior knights, warrior monks were. Most of them were poor. Of course they were poor. They were monks. And they gathered them from the monasteries, and they gathered people together, and they went over, and they were so poor, in fact, that they were called the Poor Knights. And the Poor Knights saw their job as protecting the Christians in the areas that weren't quite so hospitable outside of the region of the Levant. Because they were so noble and so dedicated and so committed to what they were doing, the rulers, the Christian rulers in Jerusalem, let them stay at what was believed to be, and we still believe it to be, the sort of rebuilt ruins of Solomon's Temple. And because of that, that's where they got their name from. The Knights of the Temple, or the Templars, the Templar Knights, that's where they came from. And they stayed there. That was sort of their headquarters in Jerusalem. But they'd sort of come back there for their rest and recreation. But while they were on duty, they were out at the far reaches on the corners of the Levant protecting it. These guys were so dedicated that every year a majority of them died in battle. That tells you a commitment level for people and for protecting the faith on even a military level. Most of them were French, but not all of them. You have to remember now, what did the Crusaders look like to the Byzantines and to the Muslims as they came across? Well, the Byzantines, by this time, they'd been around for 1,000 years, and they're very cultured, and they had fine clothes, and that was something of the case of the Muslims also. But the Europeans in the West, yeah, you remember, these are the sons of barbarians. You know, they're not particularly worried about fashion. These are blue-collar guys. when they came rolling up, they were on these great big horses. And, you know, if they had a little bit of a gut, no, it's not that big of a deal. You know, and this great big, you know, bull fur I'm wearing, it's fine. Don't worry about it. Give me a beer. That's who came crusading in to the Byzantine Empire and the Middle East, a very sort of lusty people who cared about the faith but were very earthy and had grown up like that. To them, there was one symbol that symbolized for them what the faith was. It was the sword, because it gave you earthly power and it was a symbol of your faith. The great big huge sword, this is a sword of the Knights Templar. This is a crusader's sword, a mock-up of one, I think, because I'm holding it in my hand, hasn't been cut off. But this was their symbol. That was a symbol. That sword symbolized everything of the Crusades, that we are living as long as we're living, we're fighting for the faith, and when we die, there's the cross. And different orders of knights grew up out of the Crusades. Now, as far as the history of the Crusades go, there's a famous author in the church right now, George Weigel, who's written an autobiography of the Pope. He said, and I'm quoting him, so don't call in and say anything funny to me. He said, the only problem with the Crusades is that we didn't win them. We, meaning, of course, the West and the church. The first Crusade was a success. The next five were not. Little by little, over the course of the next intervening 20 years here, 30 years there, things got really bad. There was a second crusade that was launched by Bernard of Clairvaux, Saint Bernard of Clairvaux. And in that second crusade, because the Muslim forces were now starting to eat at the edges of the Levant, starting to attack a little bit here, and they were getting a little more powerful, so he said, nope, we're going to force that back. He got the King of France and Eleanor of Aquitaine. Now, some of these names will start, you'll start going, oh yeah, I remember that name. I remember her. I don't remember what I remember about her, but I remember the name. Eleanor of Aquitaine and the King of France got a huge army together with the Germans, and they all marched in and they got blown away at the gates of Damascus. 90% of the German army was massacred in the Second Crusade. That caused a huge crisis of faith in the West. It's like, whoa, wait a second. We're the true faith? How could we lose to the infidels? What? By the time this news got back to Europe, there was this huge crisis of faith. What happened? How could this possibly happen? Remember our little description we just gave of them being, you know, these kind of lusty, you know, they were very independent. When the crusading armies had conquered the Muslims and sort of restored peace, well, now they started looking for other things to go conquer. And when they did that, they sort of became disbanded. The essential answer of what went wrong with the Second Crusade was just that. It wasn't organized. Everybody was kind of doing their own thing. So a third crusade was launched. It got set up like this. One of those earlier kind of mess up guys who's like, okay, I've conquered everything, now let me go conquer some more. He goes sailing down the Nile, this guy. We'll call him, his name's Richard, I believe. He goes sailing down the Nile and he comes across this Muslim group. Well, he kidnaps them all. Well, unfortunately for him and the rest of Christendom, one of the people he kidnapped was the sister of a Muslim general by the name of Saladin. And Saladin had kind of stayed out of the Crusades. He said, let me see how this whole happens. And, you know, well, it's fine. We'll see who I should throw my lot in with. Until this kind of jerky French guy kidnapped his sister. Well, that was the end of it. He got a 100,000 man force and attacked Jerusalem and captured it. 20,000 Knights Templar died in that battle defending the Christians that were there. It was said, and this is to show you something of the times, it was said that Saladin was a merciful conqueror because he only took 15,000 people into slavery. So let's understand that all of this history, that this is kind of the way things happened back then. It's hard for us 1,000 years later to sit in judgment with the way we see the world and pronounce judgment on how everyone back in those days saw the world. And remember, the point we're getting to here is the way the church always seems to get slammed for this, as though members of the church were the only people who ever did anything wrong, or what we would view in our 21st century eyes as kind of inhuman and cruel. This was the way the world worked back then. Right or wrong, moral or not, this is the air that everyone breathed, and they all breathed the same air. So the news gets back to Europe that Jerusalem has fallen, and a fellow by the name of Richard says, that's it. I'll go, I'll take my army. His name was Richard the Lionhearted, the son of Eleanor of Aquitaine, the King of England. Richard the Lionhearted, gathers his forces and smashes through right to the gates of Jerusalem and starts these battles. And the battles between Saladin and Richard the Lionhearted are the stuff of legend. When Richard left, finally they settled a sort of a peace truce. The Muslims still controlled Jerusalem, but safety was guaranteed to the Christian pilgrims who wanted to go in and out. So you might kind of call the Third Crusade something of a sort of a stalemate, but it was, things were better than they were before the Crusade. But the Christians still did not control the Holy Land. They just sort of were paying rent to get through it. Richard the Lionhearted, of course, you know, had to get back to England fast. Do you know why? Because his brother, Prince John, was busy trying to kill Robin Hood. Didn't know that, did you? See how these things overlap? Yeah, I knew that'd get a little chuckle. Oh, that Richard the Lionhearted. A deposed emperor from the Byzantines contacted the commanders of the Fourth Crusade and said, before you do that, could you just sort of come over here and depose my brother who deposed me and restore me to the throne? And if you do that, I'll pay you handsomely, and then you can go on and attack Cairo. So just, you know, a little warm-up before the crusade actually begins. Sure enough, the crusaders went over there, they deposed the one guy, they put him in, and like most of the Byzantine emperors, couldn't keep his word. They sat down there, the crusaders sat down there at the gates saying, where's our money? Yo, come on, where's our money? You promised us wealth and riches and gold, where is it? Well, check's in the mail, check's in the mail. Well, their patience was running out, and he stayed there long enough telling them the check is in the mail that he got deposed again. The new emperor that came in said, well, I'm not paying you anything. So the Christian armies sacked Constantinople. This is a really big sticking point between the Eastern Orthodox churches and the Catholic Church, that somehow in the twisting of history, this has been twisted to the Pope ordered that Constantinople be sacked. Nothing could be further from the truth. The Pope was having a hissy fit back in Rome saying, why aren't you in Cairo? Remember, they didn't do this on cell phones. They used to get these messages over boats and seas. So by the time you'd read something, the news was 6 months old. And he's like, what do you mean you're in Constantinople? What, I'm looking at my map. No, wait, Cairo, Constantinople, what are you doing there? But history has twisted this, and there's an awful lot of animosity on the part of the Eastern Orthodox communities that the Catholic Church sacked Constantinople. The Catholic Church did no such thing. The Pope did not order the sacking of Constantinople. That was an army set to go to Cairo to swing around and free the Holy Land. As a result, that was the Fourth Crusade. The Fourth Crusade never happened. So they tried it again. A few years later, so let's do it again, the Fifth Crusade. They sent the Fifth Crusade. Horrible, horrible result. Massacre of the army, the whole bit. By this time, we're into like the mid-1200s now, the last 50 years or so of the Crusade. Europe was getting pretty sick of the Crusades. There was a Catholic presence in the Middle East still, kind of defending it, and it was all these knights, the Templar knights, all of these people defending it, but it kept shrinking and shrinking and shrinking. And there was one last attempt at a crusade, the Sixth Crusade, in 1291. It got to the city of Acre, which is in the Galilee region of Israel, on the coastal area of Israel, and they reinforced the city, and the Turkish Muslims came and wiped it out, and then there were just a couple of pockets left, and that was it. So it started out good and just got worse. That's how they ended. So you can see now George Weigel's comment that if the Crusades would have stopped after the first one, things would have been fine. But that's not how things happened.
This is The One True Faith with Michael Voris. For more information, visit CatholicTelevision.org.
There were a lot of abuses on both sides. There were a lot of atrocities on both sides. That does not excuse Catholic behavior. It merely puts it in context. Like we said at the beginning of the show, history not understood in context is history misunderstood. There were Catholic atrocities. There were Muslim atrocities. There was betrayal on the part of Byzantine leadership and the Byzantine emperors. There was an awful lot of infighting, even among all of those other forces. There was infighting certainly in the Catholic armies. There was infighting in the Muslim armies also. When Saladin died, his entire empire he had stitched together fell apart. And you start all the little warlords fighting each other. The Catholic Church was in this, in the people of the nobility and the soldiers of Western Europe. But to take the idea that the Crusades were this Catholic aggression against a very peaceful people who were just sort of minding their own business, not true. Understand the history in its proper context. Does not excuse wrongdoing, but it merely points up this is how things were done. There was, however, another type of crusade that was going on at something of the same time. This is rightly called a crusade because of what was being fought for. While everything was going on in the Middle East, there was another problem in the West. And a lot of people don't realize that these two things interplay with each other in history. In the middle of that 200-year span of the Crusades, at the 100-year mark, there was a heresy that was developing and, in fact, had gotten a very strong foothold in southern France, a region of southern France which gave the heresy its name. The heresy was called Albigensianism, and it's named after that region of southern France. Albigensians were people who subscribed to a set of beliefs that was a mix of beliefs in witchcraft, sorcery. They denied the divinity of Christ. They denied the Trinity. They denied the virgin birth. The Pope and the Church was extraordinarily concerned about this because, unlike the Crusades where you're fighting enemies and everybody knows their enemies, here you're dealing with sort of terrorists behind the lines who are subverting every single teaching. And remember, at the time, the church and society and culture were wedded together like this. If you did some damage to the church, you did damage to the nation. And if you did damage to the nation, you did damage ultimately to yourself. So a religious threat was every bit as powerful as a military threat. In some cases, even more powerful, and this was one of them. So the church, the Pope, ordered a fellow by the name of Dominic to go into the middle of this crowd and start preaching and try to convert them back to the faith. He had some success. He took a group of men with him. They called themselves Dominicans after him. His name was Dominic Guzman, and he became known as Saint Dominic, the founder of the Order of the Dominicans. He had some success. He converted some of them back, but because of the power of the church at the time, its temporal power, there were a good number of people, French princes, who didn't want the church to succeed. If they could destabilize the power of the church, they could grab those monasteries for themselves and all those vast lands and those vineyards and all of that vast territory, and they could collect the taxes on it themselves. And so there was this kind of, you know, we'll pretend we're helping the church and we'll pretend we're loyal to the church, but in the end, we want to sort of keep this unstable so that we can eventually grab those lands for ourselves. Well, they pushed the envelope a little bit too far when the Pope had sent a special delegation into the Albigensian country. The princes encouraged a flare-up against the Pope's delegates, and they murdered them all. News like that spread all over Europe fast. It got to the French king fast, and they said, you know what, this has got to end. We cannot have a cancer like this destabilizing the entire European continent. So the kings of Europe, and particularly King of France, started a huge slaughter of the Albigensians. Now, there are a couple of movies I've seen where it looks like these are peaceful, loving little Amish people standing around like sort of frying eggs in the morning, and, you know, some horrible bishop comes in and whacks off their head. Well, however you see things portrayed in the media, don't necessarily believe them. It was a slaughter, to be sure, but it was not a slaughter that was conducted by the church. That was a slaughter conducted by the temporal rulers of Europe, and particularly the temporal rulers of France, who did not want that kind of destabilization in their own place. Imagine what the federal government's response would be if Connecticut decided to secede. Do you really think they'd say, okay, go ahead? Matter of fact, we had a civil war about that, remember? The people in charge do not like it when the people below them start an open rebellion. And that's exactly what happened in southern France in the beginning of the 13th century. It was over by the year 1229, but the sentiment for it existed. And in order to root out the remaining heretics, the church resorted to something, and here comes the big I word, the Inquisition. The Inquisition is not everything it was made up to be. And when we speak about the Inquisition is not one event in history, just like the Crusades are not one event in history. There were multiple Inquisitions that happened. None of them in Europe, aside from, so we'll talk about the Spanish Inquisition in a second, but the Inquisitions that happened in France and a little bit in Germany were very minor Inquisitions. They were trials for heretics, and you got hauled before the court and you got accused of heresy. Why was somebody worried that you were going to be a heretic? Well, the people who were hauling you in front of the church court, the Inquisition, were the state authorities. Why? Because they didn't want this to flare up again. And, as history has recorded multiple times, you were actually much safer in an Inquisition court than you would ever have been in a state-run court. The state-run court penalty was execution. What many people don't know is that at the Fourth Lateran Council in the year 1215, because the church was concerned, because the Pope and the bishops were concerned, and they saw the Inquisition might be misused in order to wreak havoc and destroy enemies, political enemies, and not really serve the real purpose of kind of getting to what the spiritual heart of the matter is. In that council, they laid out rules for how the Inquisition should be conducted. And some of the rules said nobody could be brought to the Inquisition unless, first of all, that person was a professed Christian. You couldn't haul a Muslim or a Jew in front of the Inquisition. It was to root out heresy. Jews and Muslims didn't believe what Catholics believed anyway, so, I mean, you didn't have to have a trial to figure that out. You could not torture anybody. In the end, if you were found guilty, the punishment was, and this is in church documents, the punishment for heresy was excommunication or exile or the seizure of your property. It was not the death penalty. And remember, at the time when all of this was going on, every single culture that had existed before Christianity, the death penalty was the punishment for heresy. The Jews, death penalty, death by stoning if you were a heretic. The Greeks killed you if you were a heretic. The Roman Empire killed you if you were a heretic. Christianity was notable at the beginning because everybody realized that, oh, wait a second, the Christians are being lenient here. They're not going to kill you. I mean, they'll exile you, but, you know, because there's no place for heretics, but you're not going to be killed. The death penalty only came back in when Constantine in the fourth century imposed Roman law on the church and brought the death penalty back from the old Roman laws. It sort of stayed on the books, but it was never or very, very rarely executed. That's how the Inquisition happened in southern France from the year 1200 to about the next 350 years. What you don't know is the Spanish Inquisition was totally run and administered by King Ferdinand and Queen Isabella. They insisted on an Inquisition. Why? Because they had just chased the remaining Muslims out of the country, and they wanted to make sure that these people were not seditionists, were not traitors. And word got back to Isabella and Ferdinand in 1492. More happened in 1492 than just Columbus sailed the ocean blue. When word got back to them that Muslims were in droves converting to Christianity, Ferdinand saw, I know what they're doing. They're hiding in the church, waiting for an opportunity to tear my kingdom apart. Well, I'm going to get them. And he used the church's court, the Inquisition, to drag suspected Muslim converts into court to get them to say, are you a heretic? And in the process of all of that, that is how the Spanish Inquisition got this horrible, horrible reputation. There was one fellow whose name was Torquemada. He was called the Hammerer of the Heretics. He was a sort of a bloodthirsty, mean-spirited guy. He was a monk. And no apologies for what he did. What he did was wrong. His idea of unifying the kingdom was expel all the Jews and find every Muslim you can and torture them. Well, interestingly enough, if you could imagine, Ferdinand wasn't particularly opposed to Torquemada. Why? Well, because as long as everybody was terrified of him, Ferdinand kind of kept his power. The Pope kept issuing orders to Ferdinand to say, you need to kind of put some clamps on Torquemada. Now, you've probably never heard that part of the history either, I'm willing to bet. You've probably just heard that for 300 years the church ran this horrible thing and all they did was execute people left and right. Let's put some things in perspective. In a country where who you are depends on how the state defines what it is to be that kind of person, that kind of countryman, the king gets to say, this is a Spaniard. You believe in this, 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 and this. You support me with taxes. You do these. That makes you a Spaniard. In the entire 350 years of the Spanish Inquisition, 4,000 people were executed. In 350 years. There was a period when the Protestants and Catholics were battling like mad at the end of the 16th century. The last 50 years of the 16th century, just hundreds of thousands of Catholics and Protestants died on battlefields all over Europe. Do you know the safest place to be in Europe during those 50 years? Spain. Why? Because on average, only 4 people a year were actually executed in the Inquisition during that 50 bloodiest years. So the next time somebody says something to you about the Catholics, oh, you guys have the Crusades and you have the Inquisitions, Give him a little history. It is a very poor historian who takes a look at just the common popular notions of the Crusades, the Inquisition, and slams the Catholic Church about them. Were there individual Catholics who did bad things? Absolutely. Was this some sort of church-run power play to crush this and crush that? No, it wasn't. The Inquisition in particular. 350 years, 4,000 people died. Let's put that in perspective. In one day in the United States, 4,000 babies are murdered in their mother's wombs. In one day, about that many people died when the World Trade Centers came down. The Spanish Inquisition and the church married together get a very bad rap. So it's important to remember that whenever you see in history things that say Catholic Church did bad this, Catholic Church did bad that, remember that the history is written by somebody who may or may not have an agenda. You have to be educated. You can't be a lazy-minded Catholic in today's world. There are simply too many attacks on the church, spiritual, emotional, as well as intellectual. You have to know your faith from every single side. So much of the faith has been watered down and diluted, and you haven't gotten the right story, and you don't know what's going on, and there are all of these scandals, and there's no other way to say it. There are all of these scandals that happen in the church with priests and lay people who teach things that are just flat out wrong. They're not even close to the truth. They're just wrong, and they hide them in all this gobbledygook, theologically sounding language like it's somehow far above us, and we just have to understand it. We need to become holy. That is always the call of the faithful Catholic. First and last, to be holy. Always. Now, when we confront these situations, you have to realize that, you know, when you see something that's evil, and heresy is evil, and things that go on in the church that lead people away from the truth are evil. When we see those things, we have to be willing to stand up and confront them. You know, you got a sword when you were baptized, the sword of your faith, and this is put into your hands, and you're meant to use it. You're meant to fight for the truth. You're meant to fight for the faith. This is what the monks, the warrior monks, the knights of the Crusades understood. Now, I don't mean go out and actually take a sword and chop someone's head off. I mean with grace and holiness, persevere in a holy life and be an example to others, and more than that, correct something when you see it in charity, but correct it. You know, That's each side of this. Charity, correct it. If something's wrong, you need to try to do what you can to correct it. Thanks very much for watching. We'll see you next time on The One True Faith.
This was an audio-only version of Season 2, Episode 12 of The One True Faith, produced by St. Michael's Media and hosted by Michael Voris. For more information, visit CatholicTelevision.org.
The Holy Spirit needs to take you out to the woodshed and teach you a couple of lessons.